Now I'd like to introduce to you a very close friend of mine, a man whom I have respected since seminary days. He was a very fine poet then, but I consider him a poet laureate of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at this time. He has done considerable hymn writing and translating and has done a very beautiful piece of work constantly. His ideals are great, high. There's an excellence in his work which is hard for many people to achieve when they just dabble in this kind of thing. He has not dabbled, but he has worked at it for years. And I'm happy to say that I think we're going to have a comprehensive volume of his poetry in the near future, which will be a real treasure for our church. So, Terry Vida, Reverend Terry Vida, the floor is yours. Thank you, Alan.
I'd like to say a few good things about Al, too. I don't have too much time, but I'd like to squeeze in a joke later on if I have time. But Al has been a very good friend of mine, and I'm glad to see him on campus here leading the worship aspects of the seminary training. I still remember Al helping to accompany me at a seminary concert. I think it was a choir concert, and we played during the between the performances of the choir. And I played the violin, and he accompanied me on the piano. And that was the first of our collaborations, and it's still continuing today. Happy to be your guest and also a partner. I have a little story to tell that's the follow-up of the joke that, or the story that Al just told. If I have any sense of humor at all, I think I inherited most of it from my mother, and I'm someday going to collect all her wisecracks that she did with a straight face. And I don't know if she realized she was being funny, but she was. And years later, we're still chuckling. She told about this little boy who didn't speak in their congregation. My dad was a pastor in Virginia in a small farm community there for a couple of years. And while they were there, this little boy was born. And my mother remembered that he hadn't spoken all the time that they were there, I guess for about 6 months after his birth, or maybe a year. When they left, they lost track of this family. 18 years later, this family was driving through East Chicago, Indiana, the garden spot of the United States, if you want to identify it, and stopped at our parsonage there with this 18-year-old boy. And so the parents came in, and my mother introduced them to me and me to them. And then she looked at this boy, and she says, "Is this the boy who didn't speak for such a long time?" And they said, "Yes." My mother turns to him and says, "Say something." Oh. It didn't seem funny at the time, but I later appreciated it. I didn't know how to approach this subject, because everybody writes hymns in a different way, and I think we all come to it, and those of us who do attempt to write hymns, come to this stage by various routes. And I've been reminiscing over the way I came to this point in time, if I may use a cliche, which I abhor. And if you hear me using any cliches, I wish you'd do a little charade for me. It'll not be noticeable to the people behind you, so I won't be embarrassed if I just catch your clue. I heard somewhere that, in fact, it was Dr. Grebner, who's a fellow I was here at the seminary. I asked him one day, "What is the secret of your writing ability?" I said, "You write so well, and I admire your writing, and there's something special about it." And he said, avoid the cliché. And they added, like the plague. But that's the secret of creativity. So remember that. That's a standing rule with me. I test everything. If I utter a cliche or write a cliche, it immediately jumps out at me. I become so conscious of it. But when I give talks, I ask the people to do this charade. You know what this means, don't you? What? Little, again. When you're doing hitting a tree, what do you do? Oh, another word? Hack, right? All right, and the second part of the two-syllable word is? All right, so if you do this, I can see it. I know I'm using a cliche. Okay? I found myself doing that at company meetings, and I get a sore knee after a while, hearing about this point in time and impacting on the market and so on. Okay, so how do we get to this point of writing hymns? I think it's a process that begins very early. In my case, it began in earliest infancy. I have a hard time explaining to people who talk about making a decision for Christ and being born again that I don't ever remember not being a child of God, not being born again, because I was baptized very early in infancy. And the first words that I remember ever speaking was a bedtime prayer which asked God, let me translate it because I learned it in Slovak. And that's one of the things, if you want to be a translator, be born into a bilingual family. So this prayer was, Lord God, give us a good night and give me a strong faith, a sound mind, and the gift of the Holy Spirit. Amen. I was praying that prayer at the age of 3, and I've been praying it all my life. And I think it's had an influence on me, because I think those are some of the basic gifts that we need. I remember, too, that every New Year's Eve, we had a little devotion. And I was fortunate to be born into a parsonage, into a pastor's family. And we had a devotion, and every year we sang, now greet the swiftly changing year with joy and penitence sincere. Rejoice, rejoice, with thanks embrace another year of grace. A hymn that you find in a number of hymnals today, a New Year's Eve hymn. Of course, I learned it in Slovak. And then, growing up in that ethnic community in East Chicago, my father had vacation Bible school for 8 weeks in the summertime, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And he spent at least an hour each day teaching us, little group of, we were called hunkies because our ancestors came from Austria-Hungary, little group, 25 little hunkies, they're learning chorales, the Lutheran chorales in Slovak. And we learned 40 of these. I could still recite this first stanza from memory. And these kids would sing them lustily. All those kids that I remember became leaders in the local congregation later on, established good Christian families, and were very strongly rooted in the faith. Anyway, that was some of the background that went into this trail that eventually led to hymn writing. Along the way, we had a visit from three wise men from the East. It was a delegation of Slovak cultural leaders from Czechoslovakia, who were the heads of a cultural institute there, and they were making a tour of Slovak settlements throughout the United States, and they stopped at the parsonages, which were cultural centers. And they dropped off a bunch of books, classic literature, Slovak literature, poetry and prose. And as a boy of 13, I got interested in these books, and I started reading them and got interested in poetry. And the poetry was so outstanding that I wondered, shouldn't this be appreciated by people who don't understand the language, and shouldn't somebody translate these into English? And so I set myself to start translating some of this classic poetry into English. And I did this one lyric by the greatest Slovak poet, who happened to be a strong Christian, who died in 1921, and wrote a series of 32 sonnets at the beginning of World War I, which he entitled The Bloody Sonnets. And because that has a bad connotation in English, especially in England, I changed the title to A Song of Blood, which is the way he begins the first sonnet. Translated that series of 32 sonnets into English, and then many of the lyrics, and here's one of them. Oh, wish me silence, wish me peace. The din of all this dullness grieves me. For I was meant to seek the golden fleece, and scorn for vain contention never leaves me. I do not comprehend you, nor you me. Our several aims like crossfires disagree. Mine seek the lofty, yours the nether. While marked booty to your altar clings, mine stands entwined about with genius wings. We cannot sacrifice together. What makes you happy leaves me bored. Another goal than yours attracts my sight. And while you need your murky hoard, my spirit soars aloft to yonder light, to harmony and joy where conflicts cease. Oh, wish me silence, wish me peace. 20 years later, I was shaving, and the phrase ran through my mind, now the silence, now the peace. That seed was planted there. And it doesn't ripen at once. An inspiration isn't summoned up on command. There has to be a trail that leads to the composition of a poem or of a hymn. My experience is that no experience is ever wasted. And somewhere along the way, some of this will ripen into something that is creative. Martin Franzmann gave a definition of theology. He said it was theology is doxology. And doxology of the highest rate is theological. Of course, it has to be because it's doxology. Along the way, if a person is going to write poetry, you have to learn the mechanics, just as you have to learn finger exercises when you're playing the piano. And this was another experience that I had. As I attempted to translate those poems, I had to develop a skill in writing English poetry. And because these forms were of all kinds, including the sonnet form, and to transcribe that into English required a very good acquaintance with the sonnet form until a person eventually begins to think in sonnet lines. So that I would be walking down the street and I'd think of a line like, you are the stars that stud the spacious night, and by your bright reflected light men chart eternal voyages. And that turned out to be a sonnet dedicated to our seminary graduating class. Or for me at least, the city grows old too soon, the wrinkles in the stoop come much too early, and so on. You begin to think in poetic lines. You begin to think in opening lines, and you begin to think in concluding lines. And as you practice these various forms, eventually you create a vessel into which the content or the theme or the thought can later be poured. So when you get a good thought, you don't have to begin at that time to master the basics of writing verse. So anyone who is inclined to write hymns should somewhere along the line become skilled in writing poetry. And it doesn't have to be religious poetry, because the same standards hold true for secular poetry. And if the standards aren't there for religious poetry, it is not good religious poetry. It should be able to stand on its own basis. I became introduced to hymnody early, became introduced to Slovak poetry and hymnody because I learned those chorales in that translation. But I was also influenced very much by music, and especially by Bach. And I had the privilege of having parents who were willing, my father was willing to take me on an interurban from Racine, Wisconsin into Milwaukee once a week, beginning at the age of 4, at which time he took me to hear a concert by Fritz Kreisler in Milwaukee. I came home from that concert and asked to have a violin. And we started violin lessons after that. And I still wasn't able to speak English. They didn't teach me English right away. They thought I can pick that up later on. And so I was learning theory on the streetcar to Milwaukee in Slovak. Eventually, got to play the violin fairly well, but learned to appreciate good music as a result of that. And I think anyone who writes hymns should at least be familiar with the elements of music, the structure of music, and have a standard of music to go by. Along the way, I developed a standard for quality. And I felt somehow like Isaac Watts did when I, what's that story? He went to church one time and was so disappointed in the hymnody. I guess it was psalmody at that time. And he complained about it. And whoever was with him, was that his father? His father said, if you don't like the hymnody, why don't you do better? And so he produced, what, 6,000 hymns or so on that challenge. Well, I asked workshops of this kind to set their own standards by asking themselves two simple questions. One, which hymn do you wish you had written? The next question is, which line do you wish you had written? Whenever I sing a great hymn, I say to myself, why didn't I write that hymn? Why didn't I think of that line? I sing a hymn like, my song is Love Unknown, and I just melt. And I think, oh, will I ever write a hymn of that quality? Or even Lift High the Cross. It's become kind of banal by now, but still, what content in those few lines? If I could just write a hymn like that. But ask yourself that question. And then, once you've discovered which hymn you wish you had written or which line you wish you had written, analyze it. And find out what it is about that hymn that makes you so excited. What it is about that line that grabs you. And if you can start to analyze your own writing, you're on the step, on the way to becoming an acceptable hymn writer. As for this reason, that on the back of this first outline page, I have given you some self-evaluation checks to make. But before we get to that, let me go on to the next point here in why I write hymns. I write hymns because I was troubled by superficiality of worship and hymnody. And it just bothers me that we have such a short lifetime and so few opportunities to taste the very good things that are available and to be satisfied to spend week after week after week with substandard texts or music. I just couldn't take that. I don't know how anybody else feels about it, but once you've tasted Bach, nothing else quite satisfies. And once you've tasted great hymnody, you're just not satisfied until you find something that's close to it. It bothers me when I go to a ball game, for example, and I hear the Star Spangled Banner being played, and nobody's singing it, so nobody has to keep quiet. But I say 9/10 or more of that crowd, the ball game, is not singing the Star Spangled Banner. And I remember being in Europe during the invasion of Czechoslovakia and had a taste of what that oppression was like for one day. Came back to America, and when I heard the Star Spangled Banner, I just couldn't hold back from singing it. What is it that keeps us quiet? I remember visiting many churches where they've even sung a hymn like Lift High the Cross. And I'll look around, and perhaps even half of the congregation hasn't even opened the hymnal and aren't even opening their mouths. Why is it that we deprive ourselves of quality, of something that's so magnificent, when it's there so available? And this bothered me about so much of worship and hymnody. And it's bothering me more and more as I see the way the American church is going in many of its denominations. I've discovered, too, that many hymns are me-centered rather than God-centered, and so much worship was that way. And when I analyzed the Lord's Prayer, I saw that it begins with God, and it spends three petitions on God, and finally it gets around to me in the fourth petition when it says, give us this day our daily bread. And I wonder if that balance isn't turned, structure isn't turned around in much of our worship and our worship attitudes. And it was this question that provoked the composition of Now the Silence, which I gave you a copy of. I had been in the ministry 18 years, and I had now a page to fill in This Day magazine as editor of the magazine, and the deadline for filling that page was 2 days off. The morning before the deadline, I was shaving and mulling over a question in my mind that had been bothering me for many, many years, perhaps all the 18 years of my ministry. And that is, why did David say, I was glad when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord? Was he just being poetic? Was he exaggerating? Or did he really mean it? And when I read Psalm 84, my soul longs for the courts of the Lord. Who in the world among American Christians, American youth, even in my childhood, longed for the courts of the Lord, couldn't wait for Sunday morning to get over there to church and enjoy what was going to happen? And that question has bothered me for 18 years or more. And that morning while I was shaving, I thought, what's happening when I go to church? What is taking place? And I started to think of all these items, now the silence, now the peace, now the empty hands uplifted. There's more to them than there's kneeling, there's a plea for mercy, there's the Father's arms in welcome, but there's more than that. There's the hearing that takes place, and there's the power that is in the Word, and there's the vessel that's brimmed for pouring. There's so much that God overflows any bucket that we bring to church. There is the body and the blood, the sacrament, and then the joyful celebration. The wedding takes place, and the songs of the wedding, and the heart forgiven leaping, which to me is worth going across town for just to hear the absolution spoken. That's enough to spend an hour on Sunday morning doing. We spent 45 minutes the other day in a restaurant waiting to be seated, and I thought, you could have a whole church service in these 45 minutes and use this time in a worthwhile way instead of sitting there inhaling all this smoke from the people that are waiting to be served. Okay, but there's more than this at the church service. Now the Spirit's visitation. And I thought to myself, there's got to be a doxology to this. But how does it operate? It operates really in reverse. And somebody had critiqued this hymn in the Hymn Society, in the Hymn magazine, and said that the author must have accidentally turned around the benediction. Well, it's not turned around, it's done deliberately. First of all, the Spirit comes and invites us. He visits us. Then comes the Son's epiphany in the Word and the Father's blessing over it all. And the hymn created itself. I couldn't get out of the, I couldn't get the shaving cream off my face fast enough to get into the other room and jot these phrases down. And I noticed later on there's no verb in here. And oh, and then this appeared in the magazine as an entrance hymn. And that's what it was meant to be. And I got a call from Carl Schuck, who read it in This Day magazine, and said, do you mind if I try a tune for your text? Fine. I said, but if you do, I said, end it on a G. Because I wanted this to be chanted by the congregation before the service, so that when you came to the word now at the end, it would be on a G, and it would be the note that the pastor chanted the opening, the invocation, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, was the way it appeared in TLH, the Lutheran hymnal. He did end it on a G. So this is the way it appeared, and it's had quite a history since then. And for me, this was a watershed in my hymn writing, because it freed me to get away from versified poetry and by rhymed hymnody. And I knew that I found out that you could write hymns without rhyme so long as you had two elements. One is rhythm, it's got to have rhythm, and the other is imagery. And I think you'll discover that this has imagery. And one test that I give all my hymn texts is, can this hymn be illustrated by an artist? Then I think you've got an answer whether you've got imagery in the hymn. I discovered also that there were many gaps in hymnody that still were not filled. So there were opportunities for contemporary hymns to be written that would not repeat something that had been done much better by hymn writers before. I knew I could not match Isaac Watts, but I could perhaps do something for a gap in hymnody that would give my impression. And here I must give my wife credit for the definition of style. I get so many good pointers from my wife, and I wish she'd be present, or at least would hear a tape like this to know that I give her credit. And I always intend to do that, and I tell her I do it, but she doesn't always believe me. But anyway, you know that I gave her credit, right? Her definition of style is the way you see something. So simple. And if you'll analyze any poem that has been written, it is an expression of how that particular poet saw something. And if you read a hymn by Isaac Watts, you can almost do a profile of his character and personality, and even of his theology, by seeing from which viewpoint he looks at an object, or at God's work, or at his salvation, or at his life. All that shows up, and that's your style. And I noticed that a certain style shows up in the hymns that I write. It's the way I see things. So when I was asked to write a Christmas hymn for the Augsburg Annual, the Christmas Annual, came up with, they had several suggestions. One was Angel Song. And that appealed to me. And I thought, well, has anybody ever, of the thousands of carols that have been written, has anybody done a text? Is that in here?
No.
Yeah. No, it's not in here, is it? Before the marvel of this night, didn't I get that in here? Oh, anyway, that's what came of it. I thought to myself, what were the angels doing a few hours, or even maybe if there's any time at all that we could imagine transpiring in heaven, when they were told that the Savior is going to be born at a certain hour in Bethlehem on a certain day? Well, they had to get the choir ready, didn't they? They knew what it was all about. Somebody composed those words, and they all agreed on the text, Gloria in excelsis Deo, didn't they? And I imagined this angelic choir preparing to sing that Christmas hymn for the one and only performance. And so I came up with Before the Marvel of This Night. Got to read this. Okay. Adoring, fold your wings and bow, then tear the sky apart with light, and with your news the world endow. Proclaim the birth of Christ and peace, that death, fear and death and sorrow cease. Sing peace, sing peace, sing gift of peace, sing gift of peace. Awake the sleeping world with song, this is the day the Lord has made. Assemble here, celestial throng, in royal splendor come arrayed. Give earth a glimpse of heavenly bliss, a teasing taste of what they miss. Sing bliss, sing bliss, sing endless bliss. Sing bliss, sing bliss, sing endless bliss. The love that we have always known, our constant joy and endless light, now to the loveless world be shown, now break upon its deathly night. Into one song compress the love that rules above. Sing love, sing love, sing God is love. It's the way I saw this, the way I looked at it. And to give expression to that is an expression of my style. And anyone here who would choose a theme would do it slightly differently. It's almost the way the gospel writers wrote the gospels. Each one of them saw the same event, but they saw it from different angles. And you put these together, and what a rich report you have. And some hymns I wrote simply because they came unsolicited. Not too many. Most hymns that I write are commissioned or requested. And I don't know if this is a thing to be happy about, but in all my life, I have never foisted any of my hymns on anybody. Never palmed them off on my congregation and expected them to sing them just because I was choosing the hymns. But they've come solicited, and that's very gratifying to know that. Okay. I'm going to just go through a couple of these texts quickly with you. And will 15 minutes be enough for you? Okay. Let me just use some of these samples here as examples of how some of these hymns came to be and what attempt was being made when I wrote them. If you'll turn to a couple pages down, Amid the World's Bleak Wilderness resulted from a gap in the hymnody that was being prepared for the Lutheran Book of Worship. And we were looking for a hymn of the day, which is the practice that we decided to follow in assembling that book, so that there would be a special hymn for the gospel lesson of each Sunday during the three-year lectionary. At first, we had just the one-year lectionary, and then when we expanded it to 3 years, we needed 150 hymns instead of 50, approximately. So we found out that the text for the Sunday in which the gospel lesson was John 15, 1 to 8, the vine and the branches, didn't have any hymn specifically dealing with that subject. And so we were asked to find a hymn somewhere among the 2,500 that were submitted, but not one was submitted on this particular theme. We got hundreds and hundreds of hymns of praise, but they were all duplications of what Isaac Watts did much better in the past. But there was no hymn on this text. And so I thought maybe I'd try it. I thought, why not try to visualize what's happening when a vineyard is planted and when a vine grows?
And the vine crawls along a wire, doesn't it? Like this? I thought if you set this up on end and try to visualize this with the rhyme scheme. Is there a rhyme scheme that weaves in and out that has never been used for a hymn before, but which would subliminally suggest the weaving of a vine going along a wire? And I found the Terza Rima, which Dante used for the Divine Comedy. And that rhyme scheme is A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, C, E, E. And you notice how that weaves back and forth?
And so I decided to write a hymn on this theme using the Terza Rima. But this required that the last two lines be a couplet, but that they, at the same time, should probably be the same as the first two lines here. But they could stand, the first two lines could stand by themselves as a concluding couplet. And so when Dick Hillert decided that he would try to write a tune for this melody, for this text, I suggested that he be conscious of the need to have those last two lines be identical with the first two lines, and so that you could end up logically with the first two line melody. And so he did that. And so as a result of that came about this particular text. And I sort of hid the rhymes. I used off rhymes so that this would not be visible. You would sense that there's a rhyme scheme there, but it would not jump at you. It would not knock you over. But I did want the rhyme scheme to be very strong in the conclusion, in the couplet at the end. And so I came up with this text. Amid the world's bleak wilderness, a vineyard grows with promise green, the planting of the Lord himself. His love selected this terrain. His vine with love he planted here to bear the choicest fruit for him. We are his branches, chosen dear, and though we feel the dresser's knife, we are the objects of his care. From him we draw the juice of life. For him supply his winery with fruit from which true joys derive. Vine, keep what I was meant to be, your branch with your rich life in me. Vine, keep what I was meant to be, your branch with your rich life in me. A person searches through as much theology as possible to make this consistent with the rest of the scriptures and with Christ's relationship with his believers. I tried to do that here. And interestingly enough, this text has become quite a favorite of many people. And Leslie Brandt, whom you may know as the author of Psalms Now and the Now series of books, has flattered me by doing this collection of verses that he wrote on the basis of the lines of this particular hymn. It's just come out, Meditations Along the Journey of Faith. And he devotes three or four poems to each for each line in this particular hymn. Feeling that there's more here than appears on the surface. And that's another principle that I'd like to emphasize, is that hymns should be written on more than one level. Everything should not appear on the surface so that the hymn is exhausted in one reading or one singing. There should be enough substance to a hymn, enough allusions, so that when you come back to it the second and third time, you're still finding things in it that that you missed the first time. And for that reason, I'd like to ask you to look at God of the Sparrow. Concordia Church in Kirkwood wanted... I think I'm going into your time now, Henry. Let's come back to that later on. I'm going to continue this, if you don't mind, in the second hour. But let's take up the hymn that I want to introduce Henry with, and that's the one that has achieved such a nice marriage with music by Henry, and that's Up Through Endless Ranks of Angels, the very first one in this listing. This was done at the request of Augsburg Publishing House, which was doing some sheet music and wanted a hymn on the Ascension. And they suggested a text to Our Lady Trondheim, a melody by Lindemann. And I did a text to that melody, and that's what determined the poetic structure of this particular text. It had to fit that meter. It also suggested the rhyme scheme, which was A, B, A, B, A, B. No, A, B, B, I'm sorry, A, B, C, B, D, B. That's the way it goes. And this then appeared, it was supposed to be in the Lutheran Book of Worship, but they didn't care for that melody. It didn't seem to fit the text too well, and they wanted to keep the text. And Augsburg then settled on another text that Carl Schalk wrote for this melody. And then Henry comes into the picture. Would you take it from there, Henry? Do you know Henry Gehrke? He's been with you a week and a half now, so he'll tell you the story of how music comes to be added to text.
Well, I had first seen Jerry's text that spring of 1973, when there was an Ascension service at the Lutheran Church of the Ascension, where Rod Schrank is organist, choir director, and they had sung it that evening in the service to the tune Regent Square, which is LW 218, and that was the tune that was used that evening, and I think used for quite a while. And the interesting thing about the melody is that the first two notes are descending up through, and the overarching range of the melody may be upward, but the first couple of notes went down. In the service folder that evening, the hymn was listed as the hymn of ascended triumph, and I was going to check with Rod, and I've never gotten a chance to do that, to find out who was the one that assigned those titles to the various hymns, because each hymn, they did not use the first line of the hymn, but used some designation in the service that way. A little bit later that year, in June of 73, I was taking classes here at the seminary in the Schola Cantorum that was here at the time, and Paul Monts was one of the instructors, and he had given the assignment that we were supposed to bring in new hymn texts or new hymn tunes that we'd like to introduce to our congregations. So I brought in this text, and with the tune Regent Square, and we sang through it, and one of Paul Monts' comments was that this text certainly deserves more or a better treatment than that tune. And so I started thinking about it that day, gave Jerry a call to find out what the status of the text was, of copyright and so forth, and then went over to the library to do some studying. And the mind, that was one of the few times my mind was working that way, where I started thinking through the text and looking at the first stanza of it and seeing what direction does it want to go. and outlined a melody in my head, quick scratched it down on paper, and then went up to the third floor of Winnick, and I think the piano, the old junky piano, was in as bad condition then as it is now. Went up there to try it out, and then made a couple of revisions with it, gave it and showed it to Paul Mons and the class, and did a little more looking into it. I submitted it to Augsburg, and they just kind of sat on the tune for a good long time. And the reason for submitting it to them was because they owned the copyright text to the text at the time. And after a while, I finally just asked for the tune back again. And at that time, in 1975, my choir at Unity Lutheran in Belnor, here in Missouri, commissioned Walter Peltz to write a setting of it. And it ended up being more of a choir anthem for SATB, organ and two trumpets, and with the last stanza being done by the congregation. And we first used that in 1975 on Ascension Day. And at my request, I suggested to Walter Peltz that he give it to Concordia Publishing House, or submit it to them for publication, mainly because Augsburg had sat on the tune and for so long, and I said, well, I know that Rod Schrank is interested in it. What I'd like to do is play a recording of that anthem as done by two parish choirs, and to give you an idea of that, the hymn tune in, the hymn in the hymnal is 152, if you want to look that. One of the things before I play it, you'll be able to notice, I think, is that it does a good job in presenting the tune, but it doesn't lend itself that well to congregational singing. Even the last stanza is capable of being done by congregations, but I think it's usually better done by choirs. Yeah, that, right. That setting was published by Concordia in around 1976 or 77, and has done fairly well and in introducing the two congregations, the tune. One of the interesting things I found out was that a lot of churches were using it for an Easter composition, and only because it mentioned the word Eastertide in the text, and obviously taking it way out of context to there. But then in 1984, Concordia Publishing House was coming out with the Hymn of the Day concertato series, and Carl Schock gave me a call one night, and he said, would you like to do something on your tune? And so I had that opportunity, and we'll get have a chance to go through that here also.
Well, that's why I've used it in every assessment, and very well, my congregation is now singing well. It takes time to develop and enjoy both the text and the tune. Is there a position where the words are different? I was trying to
yes.
say that. Words of Al-Barak, we are as our brother intercedes.
Right.
That was a misprint in one of those.
It was in the Walter Pell setting.
Yeah, the Walter Pell setting. And that wasn't meant to be. It was meant to be imperative, not threatened.
Right. Yeah.
Which brings up the issue of how sensitive are you to any way that it changes your poetry?
Absolutely. And that's why Timothy is copyrighted. Not because a person wants to get credit for it, but so that you can protect the accuracy of the text. So often copies are made very sloppily, especially if they're done by congregations that aren't particularly careful, and that changes the meaning of that.
In that case, it didn't remain. I was trying to figure out which one was correct.
Now, I'm very disturbed by that, and that's why I was glad that the Concordia edition here, the latest one, got it correct.
When did Carl Schalk write his choral?
That one was written, it originally appeared as a separate hymn tune sheet back around 73 also. And that tune is in D major. It's a little more lush in style. And it's a very good tune. And it was kind of interesting, I guess, from what he told me and also what Rod Schranke told me, is that his tune was the one that had been accepted for the Lutheran Book of Worship. And it was the last meeting before they were going to set it in stone or whatever they're going to do with it, that he came to that meeting with my tune in his briefcase, and he asked the committee to take a look at the tune they had accepted, and then they sang it through that way, and then played this tune, and then there was a vote on it, I guess, and so forth, and this one was accepted on it. And the tune itself, you just take a look at the second to the last page where just the tune is written out. I think you can see just the arching melody and so forth was done deliberately to depict the first stanza. Is up through endless ranks of angels. You have that upward direction there, cries of triumph in his ears, to his heavenly throne. Again, the melody going up, trying to reflect the text. And then Christ looks down upon his faithful, the melody descending there, and then again leaving them in happy tears and just ending up on the high notes at that point. Originally, I think I had it going up to high F on the last phrase. And that was one of the changes, but it would not leave out the E at all. So the tune is basically in D minor. Some have considered it almost Dorian or quasi-Dorian in style. And this setting, these copies you're welcome to keep, the stanza 4, the descant. If Barry, if you would just play the first phrase of the descant. Okay. which is a brings out the Eastertide theme and the resurrection theme. And that was suggested to me by my brother-in-law, who had written a setting of this tune for children's choir when I was directing the St. Louis Lutheran Children's Choir. And I asked him to write a setting for two-voiced children and piano. And he had incorporated that idea at that point. So I said, well, I'll take the idea and do some revision with it, but it worked out that way. If you notice on page 9 also, the last measure, evidently in keeping with Lutheran worship and Lutheran Book of Worship of dropping any amens, they have left it out here, but originally I had written one in there, and you can just improvise whatever you want there. What I thought we could do is maybe sing through the entire setting here once. And we'll just, stanza 2 is for women, and stanza 3, SAB, and the choir or the trumpet would be coming in at measure 59 then at the tail end of the choir stanza to bridge over that point and then lead into the doxology.
Time, so we'll see you in about 15 minutes.